You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I think it's about time we should get started. My name is Richard Bush. I'm a senior fellow here at Brookings and director of the Center for East Asian Policy Studies. I'm also the proud holder of the Jun Fu and Cecilia Yen Gu Chair in Taiwan Studies here at Brookings. And it's my privilege and pleasure to welcome all of you to our conference today on the subject of relations across the Taiwan Strait, retrospective and prospects for future development. We have an election coming in Taiwan in just exactly about 6 months. Because elections in Taiwan have a unique way of driving cross-strait relations, this seemed to be a good time to have this discussion. When I say we, I'm not just talking about my center at Brookings. I'm also the other organizations co-sponsoring this event are our John L. Thornton China Center, the Freeman Chair at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, represented today ably by my friend Bonnie Glazer, and the Association of Foreign Relations, which is based in Taipei, with whom we've worked on this conference and a similar one last year. And I would like to start my thank yous by recognizing the big contributions that the chairman of the Association of Foreign Relations, Ambassador Francisco Oh, made to making possible this event. I'd like also to recognize our colleague Huang Kuibo, who's the executive director of the association and a former visiting fellow here at Brookings. I need also to thank my own staff here at Brookings who have worked with CSIS and the association to bring all this off. This is a little bit of a sad day for us at the center because Kevin Scott, who's been my associate director and core of the center for 13 years, is being promoted to a position in the front office of the foreign policy program. He will still be with us, but he will not be for us. I want to convey my deep gratitude for all the hard work he's put in for more than a decade and the contribution he's made to our work. I should also recognize some special guests. Ambassador Shen Lushun from the Taipei Economic and Cultural Office. Raymond Burkhart, the chairman of the American Institute in Taiwan, a position I held for a couple of years. Joe Donovan, who is the managing director of AIT. It's very nice to have them here, and we will hear from Ray later in the day. Right now, however, we are going to hear from our keynote speaker, Andrew L.Y. Sha. He's the Minister of the Mainland Affairs Council of the Executive Yuan in Taiwan. He is a foreign service officer by training, and he has held a number of important positions in Taiwan's Ministry of Foreign Affairs. Among other things, he was the director of the Taipei Economic and Cultural Office in New York City. And in that capacity, he did a lot of hard work from 2007 to 2011 to try to expand Taiwan's international space, because New York is where the UN is based. And he had some success. I'm sure he wished that he could have had a lot more success, but that was not because of any lack of capability on his part. He has been in effect, Taiwan's ambassador to Indonesia and to India. He was deputy minister of defense before taking his current position. And we're very pleased to have him speak to us today on whatever he wants to talk about. It's my great personal honor to welcome him to the podium. Andrew?
Thank you very much, Richard, for the kind words. Dr. Bush, Director of Center for Northeast Asia Policy Studies of the Brookings Institution, Dr. Richard Bush. Ladies and gentlemen, honorable scholars, a very good day to you. It's always nice to come back to Washington after quite a few years. I used to work here in Washington in TACRO. After that, I tend to come back from time to time. And it's very nice to come back and see so many old friends here in the room. Well, the Many Affairs Council is quite honored to hold this conference again with the Center for Northeast Asian Policy Studies at the Brookings Institution and the Association of Foreign Relations in Taipei. This is my first visit to Washington since becoming Minister of the Many Affairs Council. I would like to take this opportunity to exchange with you firsthand experience and views on recent developments in cross-strait affairs. Ever since taking office in 2008, President Ma Ying-jeou has vigorously promoted a mainland policy centered on peace and prosperity. Maintaining the status quo in the Taiwan Strait is supported by the majority of the people in Taiwan. It is also the core of the ROC government's mainland policy. But what exactly is this status quo of the Taiwan Strait? Since 1949, Taiwan and the mainland of China have been divided by the Taiwan Strait and governed separately, with neither side exercising jurisdiction over the other. The ROC government is adamant in maintaining the cross-strait status quo of non-unification, no independence, and no use of force. Now, I have to make one note here that when people say no independence, I remember when I was in New York, after the speeches by the president about no independence, one of our diplomatic allies came to me and said, "Well, Mr. Ambassador, I knew until today that you were not an independent country. Otherwise, why should not you declare independence?" So I have to explain to them that internationally, the Republic of China and Taiwan is a sovereign, independent country. When we say no independence, we basically mean that no permanent separation from the concept of China. And these three no's under the ROC constitution framework and consolidating the ROC sovereignty is what being dear to President Ma's heart. It is also committed to preserving peaceful and stable development across the Taiwan Strait. Moreover, on the 1992 consensus basis of one China with respective interpretation, cross-strait official interactions and institutionalized negotiations have served to safeguard the interest and well-being of the public. They have also paved the way to broader cross-strait exchanges and contacts in various spheres. And they have created conditions for Taiwan's steady development. This is the status quo of the Taiwan Strait, one that enjoyed by 75% of the people of Taiwan, among whom include candidates in the incoming future presidential election. An important question, however, is how can the cross-strait status quo be maintained? Looking back at vicissitude of cross-strait ties, it is clear that the status quo of peace and stability achieved under the Ma administration was not pulled out of thin air. It was built on an interlinked, complementary, and truly feasible, ultra-stable framework for peace, Maintaining this status quo has, moreover, depended on the existence of four solid cornerstones. And the first of these cornerstones is the 1992 consensus of one China with respective interpretation. Crucial to this consensus is its insistence on the ROC's sovereignty and on Taiwan's dignity. The term 1992 consensus was coined in 2000, year 2000, by Dr. Su Qi, the former national security advisor to President Mao. Some people are reluctant to accept this term, but the significance of the 92 consensus and the historical facts at that time must be respected. The consensus is also one that both sides can accept across the Taiwan Strait, underlying the mutual trust vital to the maintaining the stable status quo in the Taiwan Strait. The second cornerstone is made up by core principles of institutionalization and constructiveness that push forward cross-strait relations. The ROC government is committed to promoting institutional and constructive cross-strait ties. Promoting institutionalized cross-strait negotiations and official and private contacts. These are stabilizing factors in normalizing interactions and upgrading the stability of cross-strait relations. The third cornerstone is President Ma's three pillars for national security. These are formed by three lines of defense, namely the use of cross-strait rapprochement to realize peace in the Taiwan Strait, the use of viable diplomatic methods to establish more breathing space in international community, and the use of military strengths to deter external threats. They ensure cross-strait peace and national dignity and security. The fourth and the last cornerstone is formed by the four principles in handling cross-strait relations. These are putting Taiwan first for the benefit of the people, maintaining the cross-strait status quo of no unification, no independence, and no use of force, adhering to an interaction mode based on mutual non-recognition of sovereignty and mutual non-denial of authority to govern, and applying the democratic mechanism of national need, public support, and legislative oversight as the fourth benchmark in the handling of cross-strait affairs and sequential promoting of cross-strait interaction and exchanges. Now, over the past 7+ years, the two sides, based on this ultra-stable framework for peace, have started institutionalized negotiations on economic, trade, and security issues to advance the interest and well-being of the people on both sides, protect the security of Taiwan's society, and promote Taiwan's economic development. More importantly, the two sides have, via the liaison and communication mechanism launched last year between the Mainland Affairs Council and the Mainland's Taiwan Affairs Office, begun to normalize official contact. This marks an important milestone in the development of cross-strait relations. It has also lifted cross-strait ties to the greatest level of peace and stability in 66 years. Currently, more than 8 million people cross the Taiwan Strait each year for tourism, business visit, and other exchanges and contact that foster mutual understanding. Moreover, the number of mainland students studying in Taiwan has increased in the past 7 years by nearly 40-fold, from 823 students to over 32,000. Cross-strait internet users and students discussed current affairs and shared points of views across the geographic barriers. Taiwan has made an impact in its interaction with the rapidly changing mainland China through its unique way of life and the quality of its pluralistic society. These interactions have borne and conveyed the value of democracy, freedom, human rights, and the rule of law to guide the mainland toward institutional reform. The result of improved cross-strait relations and positive interactions in recent years have also spilled over to Taiwan's external affairs. Though not entirely satisfactory to us, they have given Taiwan more latitude for international participation. They have also earned Taiwan's plaudits from international community. U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for East Asia and Pacific Affairs, Daniel Russell, has on several occasions praised the improvement and progress in cross-strait relations under the Ma administration. Deputy Assistant Secretary of State Susan Thornton also emphasized in a recent speech that both sides should endeavor to establish a foundation for sustained peace and stability. Therefore, as we work to promote and maintain cross-strait peace and prosperity, we are also deepening the strategic relationship between Taiwan and the United States, consistent with the strategic interest of the U.S. in the Asia-Pacific region. There are, of course, some who worry if Taiwan has not inclined too much toward China. I'd like to emphasize, however, that the mainland's rise has presented a new international situation and order that has prompted many major countries, as well as surrounding region, to successfully adjust interaction strategies and strengthen political and economic relations with the Chinese mainland. Taiwan, as the mainland's next-door neighbor, is particularly unable to ignore this change. Over the past 7 years, Taiwan has strengthened trade and economic interactions with the mainland. However, its economic dependence on the mainland has fallen from the pre-2008 level measured by the data on cross-strait trade exchanges, cross-strait investment, offshoring, and other criteria. And in terms of cross-strait political affairs, Taiwan has stood firm in its insistence on sovereignty and dignity. Nearly 70 years of diversion and separate governance across the Taiwan Strait have created differences in way of life, system, and value between the two sides. More than 7 years of efforts have progressively advanced cross-strait awareness and understanding, but fundamental and intractable political differences remain. The two sides are still unable to establish real mutual trust, which has led to occasional friction between the two sides when dealing with high political issues and has also extended to conflicts on issues of security and international participation. It is also the fundamental factor that has always created estrangement, suspicion, and psychological opposition between the two sides. The mainland has never understood why its expression of goodwill to Taiwan has failed to win the minds and hearts of the Taiwanese people. Public opinion survey commissioned by the Mainland Affairs Council show that up to 60% of the Taiwanese people feel that the mainland is unfriendly toward Taiwan. Many of my friends around the world told me that the mainland's confidence is growing. But personally, I think the mainland is actually fearful, facing an uncertain future, and afraid that it might lose all that it has gained. This has prompted it to constantly adopt safeguards and precautions that frequently touch on deep water region and sensitive areas between the two sides. This is also the key factor that has caused the recent setback and tension in cross-strait interactions. One example is the mainland's attempt to break the intangible and tangible boundaries across the Taiwan Strait. The mainland has recently rolled out a series of unilateral measures aimed at Taiwan, such as the establishment of the M503 air route, implementation of the visa-free treatment and car-formed mainland travel permits for Taiwan residents, passage of Taiwan-related provisions under the national security law, and the proposal to ensure the practice of one country, two system, and advance China's reunification in accordance with the law. This has met with outcries in Taiwan. The mainland leader has made statements saying that the mountain will shake, they have adopted the principle of first cross strait, then international, placed roadblocks of at every turn to block Taiwan's participation in NGOs relevant to the people's livelihood, regional economic integration participation, and bilateral FTA negotiations with other countries. This has inevitably been a cause of concern and disappointment to the people of Taiwan. As such, the mainland's contradictory initiative in response to development in Taiwan have, in some respect, had the unintended effect of widening the psychological distance between the two sides. This has created the predicament of a self-fulfilling prophecy in which the more one cares, the easier it is for one to lose. I'm convinced that these challenges and differences can only be resolved with the stronger confidence on both sides. Tension and conflict have inevitably appeared in the past 20 plus years of cross-strait relations. However, relations will ultimately return to the moderate path of putting the people's well-being first, regardless of how the situation evolved. The welfare of the people must be considered, and the mainland must also fulfill its responsibility to maintain cross-strait peace. I would like to offer four suggestions for pragmatic development, at the same time call out to the mainland. First, institutionalized cross-strait negotiations must not stall, and the benefits created for the people's well-being must not be retracted. Second, official interactions must be strengthened under the principles of integrity, and communication must be based on sincerity and goodwill. Third, cross-strait exchanges must be sincere, political objectives and calculation must be put aside for the two sides to truly be of one mind. Fourth, the world is just one family. Taiwan, as a peacemaker, a contributor, cannot be excluded from the international affairs, and marginalizing Taiwan will only lead to alienation and resentment. Facing a complex terrain ahead, and in the coming year of President Ma's administration, the government will persist in the following important work with the goal of creating happiness and benefit for the people. First, the utmost effort will be made to maintain peace and stability of cross-strait relations. Second, the government will promote institutionalized cross-strait negotiations and convene the 11th round of high-level cross-strait talks. It will also strive to reach an early consensus on issues such as trade in goods and on the Strait Exchange Foundation and Association of Relations Across the Strait, establishment of reciprocal institutions, expand benefits from the 20-some signed agreement in effect, and fully carry out congressional oversight and communication with the public. Three, the government will work to complete policy acts that protect the welfare and interests of the people in both sides, such as the right and interests of mainland students and spouses living in Taiwan, and expand in-depth intellectual exchanges between the people of both sides. The fourth, the Mainland First Council is planning to visit mainland in the second half of this year. We will also strengthen the effective operation of the communication and liaison mechanism with the Taiwan Affairs Office. Fifth, the government will actively participate in international community and regional economic organizations. Looking to the future, we will consolidate the cornerstones for a stable framework for peace in order to preserve forward on a sure footing. In this process, we hope that the mainland will face the ROCs seriously, respect Taiwan's dignity and public opinion, and not hesitate in facilitating cross-strait work, but rather further build momentum. In addition, the Republic of China is grateful to the United States government and private sectors for their long-standing support to Taiwan. The deepening of Taiwan-U.S. relations and the U.S. affirmation of Taiwan's cross-strait policy contribute to the consolidating peace and stable development across the Taiwan Strait, while at the same time, it also strengthened the U.S. strategic layout in the East Asia region. Finally, I would like to thank you very much for your attention and like to wish this conference a full success. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Minister Shaw, for those remarks. I think they were candid, concrete, and quite insightful. And I'm sure they've provoked a lot of questions. I think they will be friendly questions, not like the you get sometimes in the legislative yuan. So I will call on people as I see hands. When you are recognized, please wait for the mic. A mic will be coming. Identify yourself and your affiliation, and keep your question short. As you can see, Minister Shaw is a very intelligent person, and he will understand your question if you do it briefly. I saw the first question there. Mike, there we go.
Hi, good morning. My name is Dr. Donna Wells. I'm a mathematician. I make predictive math models. Can you talk about, in terms of exports in the developing world, where Beijing and Taipei compete? Thank you.
Well, I think for Taiwan, we have upgraded our industry long ago because we know that manufacturing for the world is not our business anymore. We need to upgrade our industries from the labor-intensive into sort of a tech-intensive industry. So we moved most of them to mainland China. However, during the past maybe 20 years, China has also been growing economically and upgrading its industry as well. So the Taiwanese business community investing in China actually are moving out of China, a lot of them, all moving into the inland of mainland China. That is why when I was in Southeast Asia, I saw the influx of many Taiwanese investors from not just Taiwan, but also from mainland China moving to Indonesia, Thailand, and Malaysia.
If I can follow up on the question, are Taiwan companies competing with mainland companies in the China market itself, the mainland market itself?
I think so, because to many Taiwanese businesses, it is absolutely essential that they have to diversify their business, not just for manufacturing, exporting, but to fight for the huge Chinese market, as China is also transforming its economy from a manufacturing into a domestic consuming market.
Okay, thank you. I saw a hand back there. I can't see who it is. Just about the last row there.
Thank you very much. I'm Wayne Morrison with the Congressional Research Service. You mentioned that Taiwan is attempting to negotiate free trade agreements with other countries, which it has every right to do since it's a member of the WTO, but China continues to interfere politically to block that. And my question is, shouldn't your government just tell the mainland Chinese that if you want to expand ECFA, if you want a trade and goods agreement, we're not going to negotiate with you until you move out of the way? Or there's an agreement, if we sign this agreement with you, then you're going to eliminate your political involvement in our attempts to negotiate FTAs with other countries. Thank you.
Well, we did tell the Chinese that firstly, it's our legitimate right to negotiate free trade with other members of WTO. And China always trying to make a point that you have to negotiate with me first before you can talk to anybody else. But for us, we think it goes both ways. We are negotiating with China on ECFA and the trading goods and on services. But when we deal with other countries, except a very limited few at this moment, I think Singapore and New Zealand have signed. The other countries are rather reluctant to undertake this negotiation with us because somehow they were haunted by this quote-unquote one China principle, and they thought need to have the green light from China. So we are still working very hard on quite a few countries in our region as well as in South America.
Question over here.
Hi, Idris Ali from Reuters. Obviously, your position on China's new national security law is pretty well known. Has that or will it have any effect on economic ties between you and China? And the second question is, the Chinese leader is expected in Washington in September, and almost certainly the Taiwan issue will come up. In your talks with officials in Washington, has that come up? And are you at all concerned about the meeting between the two leaders in September? Thank you.
Well, second question, I think we are fairly confident in the position of the U.S. administration in terms of its relationship with Taiwan. I think the issue will be raised, it will be discussed, but based on our past relationship with the United States, the Taiwan Relations Act, the Six Assurances, we are confident that our security and interest will not be compromised by the visit. We are very concerned with the national security law passed recently by China because it somehow unnecessarily involved the people in Taiwan to protect the quote unquote the sovereignty and integrity of China. We lodge our protest and we don't think that will ever apply to us, and we made it clear that any unilateral action taken by the Chinese will not affect our legal rights. We don't know yet. I guess at this moment, we don't see the impact yet.
How well is the investment protection agreement between Taiwan and the mainland being implemented, to speak specifically to economic relations?
Well, it's being implemented for a while, and there are complaints, of course, but they all already established a channel of settling those complaints, either through the economic ministry, there's a forum for that, and also the Strait Exchange Foundation has set up a window to solve problems. The Notice 62, which the Chinese is trying to regulate the incentives given to foreign investors, and that we're very worried that will affect some of the investors from Taiwan. After a series of protests and conversation with the Chinese through my office, through the Strait Exchange Foundation and the Economic Ministry, I think they later issued Notice 25, reassuring all the Taiwanese business that all the new regulation will not have a retrospective effect on them.
Okay, thank you. Back in the back, Mike Fonte.
Thank you. Mr. Shah, for your fine presentation. I'm Mike Fonte. I work as the director of the DPP's mission here in Washington. You said that no independence means no separation from the concept of China. Seems to me no unification means no integration with the concept of China. So there's a bit of a maldun there, a bit of a contradiction, it seems to me. And it seems to me that the question of what maintaining the status quo it means, and I like your comment on this, is that it's up to the people of Taiwan to decide which way they want to go. And that's in the status quo as it is now. My understanding is it's a democracy. People like what they have. So I wonder if you think that this question of the ultimate decision must be up to the people of Taiwan, where that fits in your conversation. Thank you.
Well, because we still having this constitution under which this is a one China constitution, even of the Republic of China. So when we say status quo, we maintain status quo as it is now. The Republic of China maintain its sovereignty and its governing power over the territories and people we governed. I think under the current situation, we say status quo means that we will not talk about unification, we will not talk about independence, and we will talk about the use of force against each side.
Norman Fu in the back.
Yeah. Norman Fu. I'm a columnist of the China Times. Minister Xia, good to see you. My question will probably force you to wash some dirty linen in public. I want to ask you whether it was really true that one of your deputies, Dr. Zhang Xianyao, was accused of being a spy for Communist China, although he has been cleared, acquitted by the court. But still, there's a lot of mystery shrouding this particular case, and the speculation is that there was really some personal animosity between his boss, your predecessor, and this Dr. Chang. Can you shed some light on this case? It's just inconceivable that somebody occupying such an important position should be engaged in espionage for China.
Well, this is a sensitive and tough question. But coming from Norman Fu is no surprise. I went to the office in February, and I was told about this case. And it's not the court decided. The public prosecutor decided not to launch a prosecution because of the lack of evidence. But also because the public prosecutor's statement was listed as confidential, so we cannot discuss that openly. But all I'm trying to say is that from the brief statement made by the public prosecutor's office, that Mr. Zhang obviously handed over some papers to a friend of his to an unknown destiny. I think for any public service, it certainly is not appropriate to do that. Secondly, if you ask me, Mr. Zhang, apart from having an office in the Many Affairs Council, also has a private office in Kaohsiung, sponsored by a businessman. Again, being in government service for 30-some years, I don't think that appropriate as well. Thirdly, being a political appointee, Mr. Zhang, I think we all serve at the pressure of our president. When the president say, thank you very much for your service, you just go. You don't ask questions. So that, I guess, is the response I can give to you now. Because most of the content of from the public prosecutor's office are marked confidential. So if I discuss that with you, I'll be prosecuted very soon.
Okay, Nadia Tsao.
Hi, Minister Xia, welcome back to Washington in a different capacity this time. In your speech, you just mentioned you think that actually China is less confident in your assessment. Based on what we're seeing now, arresting of so many lawyers in China and tighten their control on NGO, what do you think this trend will have an impact on China's Taiwan policy? Especially if there is a possibility there will be a new party in Taiwan after 2016, do you think China will take a tougher stance? And the second question is, you said that China take so many unilateral actions on Taiwan policy, but besides on protesting all these measures, what can Taiwan do? Thank you.
But that's what make the work in the Many Affairs Council so challenging, because a lot of issues truly can be taken by China only unilaterally, which again to most of the business people is very convenient. For example, to give them visa waiver status, and also to transform the Taiwan the travel permit into a car form, which again look almost identical to that of people from Hong Kong and Macau. We don't like it, of course, and we have to protest. And we are actually talking to the mainland Chinese that if you want to win the minds and hearts of the Taiwanese people, this is actually the opposite way to go, by unilaterally trying to win the people without without even taking into account the dignity and respect of the people on Taiwan. And that is just one example. There are quite a few too. So when I say China is somehow people thought that China has getting more powerful in terms of its position, in terms of its interactions with Taiwan. But we see that China actually is worrying, is concerned with the upcoming election in Taiwan. They are worried because they don't know what will happen. But this is the beauty of a democracy that you just don't know. And for us, we urge Chinese, and we also ask our American friends to talk to, when they talk to Chinese, they have to know that Taiwan is a democracy, and to maintain peace and stability, that after 7 or 20 years of hard work, it's not easy. It's not just come from thin air, as I said. We work very hard to that, and we don't want anyone to unnecessary sabotage or damage that good relationship.
I think we've seen the same lack of confidence in the way Beijing has handled Hong Kong in the last 2 years, particularly the issue of electoral reform. What's your observation about the results in Hong Kong, which I think were disappointing all around?
Well, we watch Hong Kong very closely, and obviously we also are concerned with the level and the latitude of the freedom, democracy that given to the people of Hong Kong. We are disappointed, of course, and we certainly hope that the Beijing regime will respect the people of Hong Kong of its freedom to choose.
Okay, thank you. Another question over here.
Good morning. My name is Tan Lu Reichman. I'm a freelance translator and interpreter, so that means I'm very sensitive about language. One thing I notice in growing up in mainland China, I noticed that whenever we talk about, for example, Ma, we don't say, you know, President Ma. We say the chair of the Kuomintang Party. And if we have to say president, we say quote-unquote president. So during your speech, I noticed you've been saying mainland China or mainland. But during the Q&A section, we've been talking about China versus Taiwan. So I'm just wondering, is there any kind of guideline or, in Taiwan, how to deal with this? And what is, you know, speaking of people's will, how do people, and especially young people nowadays, refer to, you know, China or Taiwan?
You certainly are a very good interpreter. I mean, when I, officially, because of the position I'm taking in the government, so when I refer to mainland China, I have to say mainland China, 中国大陆. But sometimes when I talk in English to friends, I refer to mainland China or just China, but I literally meant mainland China.
Another question? Was there one in the back? Yes, Kent. Okay, the lady right here.
I'm a student at SAIS. Thank you, Mr. Shaw, for giving us a wonderful speech here. Because you serve at MOFA before and Ministry of Mainland Council before, so I would love to ask you this question. How do you think maintaining the status quo, especially under the One China policy framework, can give young Taiwanese generation, the future generation, more international opportunities and more international participation? Thank you.
I think the younger generation being raised in the age of internet, they know cyberspace. They are much more inclined to become quote-unquote citizens of the globe. National boundary for them is not necessary, and it will hurt their feelings if they will stop participating in certain activities because of the issue of national boundaries. So I think for the Chinese, for the mainland Chinese, they have to know that even though their policy is to win the minds and hearts of particularly the young people in Taiwan, the Sanzhong Yiqing, the younger people, but it's a difficult job to do. I mean, the younger people, you know, unlike when we grew up in Taiwan, the classroom is very strict, that all the doctrines are there, were there. But nowadays, it's just free thinking. So for the mainland Chinese to try to educate them about quote unquote, you know, the motherland, the Chinese, it will be a very difficult task. Similar to that of Hong Kong, if you see the people walking on the street demonstrating, they're mostly young people, and that will teach the mainland Chinese lesson.
Okay, we have time for one more question. Who will it be? John Zong? Okay. Sorry to put you on the spot. Okay, anybody? Okay, back there. Thanks. Rick Fisher, sorry. Defense.
Thank you, Mr. Shah. I just wanted to give you an opportunity to explore some of the military developments by China in the Taiwan theater that contribute to fear and lack of trust, as you mentioned. Thank you.
As a former Deputy Minister of Defense,
Well, as you see, in our defense strategy, we are building up innovative asymmetrical weapons, which will make sure that Taiwan is not easily invaded or attacked. And through the support of the United States, we do have the capability to preserve peace, stability in the Taiwan region for a certain period of time. So I think that, again, make China uncomfortable. But for all that, we still need to make good use of our hardwares as well as training of our own people. As you know, we are transforming into all professional, all volunteer forces, which I'm sure will be much more efficient than the current system of conscription.
Thank you very much. I think that we're going to bring this part of our conference to a close, but I would like to express my personal gratitude to you. I think you've set an excellent context for the discussions for the rest of the day. You've also set a very high standard for all of us to meet, so we appreciate that very much. We're going to have a coffee break, but I would ask you, is the audience... No break? Oh, okay. Okay. I thought we were going to have a break. Well, we're not going to have a break. So please join me in thanking Minister Andrew Shaw for an excellent set of remarks. Thank you. I'll see you. So I have to rush. Okay.